Airspeed. Does it trump every other factor in setting up a good landing? I'm Paul Plagg, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Bob also has his own flight training school in the Buffalo, New York area. Bob, thanks for taking some time out today.
As always, it's my pleasure, Paul.
In your latest edition of Over the Airwaves, you wrote about airspeed control, the ultimate requirement for landings, or the ultimate requirement for safe landings. Now, I know for students among us, there are any number of things that are, you know, deemed very important on that last few seconds before touchdown. What makes airspeed the most important of all?
Well, airspeed is truly the key to a safe and predictable landing. Land too fast, we run out of runway, the airplane will not stay planted on the ground. We have all kinds of control issues trying to bring the airplane to a stop. Land too slowly, we can wind up stalling just above the runway. We might get into a situation where we're very close to, particularly on a downwind to base or base to final turn too slow, where we could get into a stall and eventually a stall spin scenario. What sparked my writing of this article was a very tragic accident that occurred in May 2007 when a Lance Air was landing at the Mountain Air Airport in Burnsville, North Carolina. And a short, narrow runway, the pilot came in too fast, landed almost halfway down the runway, careened off of the side of the runway, took out an SR-20 and a Cessna, light Cessna twin, and it was a disaster with fatalities, and it all had the markings of just poor speed control on final.
Well, I noticed that you mentioned the guy touched down halfway down a runway, which was already marginal for the aircraft, and then did not appear to attempt to go around.
Yeah, big question as to why that happened. You know, there's only two reasons, I think, that we're committing ourselves to landing, and that is if we're either on fire or out of gas. In both of those conditions, we have to get the airplane on the ground. But short of that, there should never be an urgent reason why we cannot do a go-around if things are not just right. And I go back to the old adage that the key to a safe landing or a good landing is a stabilized approach. And if we can get that airspeed stabilized on the downwind and really finely tuned on the base and then honed to perfection on final, every landing should be spot on and at precisely the right airspeed for a smooth rollout and exit from the runway.
All right. I guess I have to ask you to play devil's advocate here. If the guy had been at the proper altitude, might not that have been a contributing factor? I mean, obviously, if he didn't touch down until halfway down the runway, on a runway that was already going to be marginal for this aircraft, is that not part of it?
Yes, that very well could have been part of it. Now, if he had been high on the approach, according to the accident report, as I recall, the speed brakes on that airplane, which are very, very effective, were not deployed. And that fact suggests that the pilot was perhaps operating with less than optimal proficiency. Although he had factory training on the airplane, again, I'm just going from recollection here of the NTSB report, but I think he had just a limited number of hours in that particular make model airplane. And the Lance Air, like the Cessna 400, its cousin, and the Cirrus SR-22, they're wonderful airplanes, but they're very fast and they're very slick. And optimal speed control is essential to landing these airplanes safely.
I will confess that the first time I had a chance to fly a Cirrus SR-22 G3 and brought it in for landing, I ended up coming in kind of fast because, frankly, it was faster than what I was used to. And, you know, I was just not prepared to slow it down as quickly as it needed to be slowed down in order to, you know, to make it an optimal landing. It was a fine landing. I mean, it was, you know, a little chirp and it rolled out straight and everything else, but I would have liked to have been closer to hearing the little horn go off.
Well, again, you know, those of us that are training on Cessna 172s and Piper Warriors and traditional trainers, you know, we have to prepare students to the fact that The airplanes that are coming out on the line today are not your grandfather's airplanes, like the older style, older model trainers that many of us are training on. The sleek wing, high wing loading airplanes, these have characteristics more attuned to a fighter jet than they do to a trainer. And so my recommendation to anybody who's stepping up to one of these glass composite airplanes, commit yourself to extensive flight training and recurrent training for at least a year or two until you're confident that you can operate these airplanes in all flight regimes. In fact, I think Cirrus was offering at one point, perhaps they still are, to their customers an arrangement where they could actually be assigned a flight instructor for the first full year after purchase in order to ensure that they were making the transition to these sleeker aircraft more effective.
That is called the Cirrus Access Program, and it is still running. And I don't know, frankly, how many people have taken advantage of it, but what an idea.
I think it's a wonderful idea. And we just see, you know, the accident record with the Cirrus is not the fault of the Cirrus. It's the fault of the pilot that is improperly trained or incompletely trained to operate these wonderful airplanes. I think they're the nicest design out there. The Cirrus and the Cessna 400, they're just wonderful airplanes. And just now, wait until the very light jets come along. Here again, I mean, this is going to magnify the problem enormously. There's a lot of concern among the flight training community as to, you know, those that can afford are not necessarily those that are the most qualified to be flying these airplanes.
Well, Bob, you sound like you're defining a problem that dates back to the Bonanza.
Yeah, well, there you go. Sure, that's a classic example. You know, just too much money chasing too much airplane for the skill set that the purchaser has. I think that's something that can be fixed. It's just, you know, the FAA hasn't done anything about it. They're not making a type rating required for any of these newer airplanes, except the jet, of course. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, there's lots of reasons why this is, and it's unfortunate.
My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking, as I do each Monday, with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves on safety topics. And Bob, one of those that you discussed in the June edition of Over the Airwaves was proper crosswind landing technique. Now, I guess I've always heard anecdotally that there were two correct ways to come in a crosswind. One was to adopt a crab attitude and then be able to straighten it out just in time to touch down on the runway. The other was the upwind wing low method, where you lean the aircraft using the stick or the yoke into the wind, and if necessary, take it all the way down to a one-wheel landing and make a stable landing that way. Is it your contention that the wing low method is the only really correct method?
Well, yeah, and you're raising an interesting point. You know, how do we configure the airplane on short final? And that's an issue that I don't think is nearly as important as how we configure the airplane as it's settling down just above the runway. On short final, all we really need to do is just track the direction of the airplane so that it reaches the end of the runway somewhere near the center line. But once we're over the runway, this is where the real problems begin to develop. And we have to recognize that what we are taught to do in airplanes is just the opposite of what we were taught to do in cars, in automobiles, when we learned how to drive. In driving, for example, if we got ourselves into a skid on an automobile, which is akin to a crosswind situation in an airplane, we were always taught to drive or steer into the direction of the skid. All right. Now, if we steer the airplane into the direction in that direction on an airplane, basically what we're doing is rolling the upwind wing higher into the air, which is can certainly cause an upset. And it's hard to describe this without taking a little model and putting it out over a pretend runway to see exactly what I'm trying to describe here. But if we can just imagine landing with a crosswind from the left. Okay, with a crosswind from the left, that the airplane is going to yaw into the direction of the wind because the crosswind is pushing on the vertical tail.
Right.
Okay, it's weather vaning the airplane. So if we were in that situation, we're going down the runway, but we're pointing, our nose is pointing to the left. If we use the skills we were taught to correct a skid in an automobile, we would take the yoke or the stick and turn it to the right, into the direction of the skid, if you will. And if we take the wheel, yoke, or stick and turn it to the right, with wind coming from the left, what's the left wing going to do? It's going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely what we don't want it to do. So the technique that I think is really the only technique to use in a crosswind landing situation is to figuratively and literally lean the airplane into the wind, causing that upwind wing to ride lower than the other wing, and use aggressive, hard opposite rudder to keep the nose aligned with the runway. And secondly, once we are on the runway, keep those control inputs in just as the same. We call this the follow through. In other words, keep leaning into the wind with the stick or the yoke, all the way until the airplane comes to a stop and is safely under control, even to the tax, all the way up to the exit point of the runway.
You know, I fly experimental gyroplanes, and some of those things are wired up so that the nose wheel is not free castering, but actually spring coupled to the rudder pedals. And I know a lot of tailwheel aircraft have the tailwheel coupled to the rudder pedals. That would be a huge argument to not try to do a crabbed landing, because if you're a little bit quick to get it on the ground and you still have the wheel that steers you, off center, you're talking ground loop. And I understand that problem. Let me, at the risk of reigniting that bar fight that is high wing, low wing, let me ask you if a low wing airplane is trickier to land with one wing low.
I fly them both routinely, and maybe I'm just insensitive, but I cannot tell the difference between a high wing performance or a low wing performance coming over the runway. Honestly, if you're in a low wing airplane and you do not use those proper control inputs, the same problem is going to happen. Whether the wing is 3.5 feet above the runway or 6 feet above the runway, depending on where it's attached to the fuselage, the aerodynamics are exactly the same. If the gusty wind gets under that wing, that upwind wing, and lifts it, we're going to be in a situation where a prop strike is almost inevitable.
Well, I have to ask you this, though, just because I don't know. I have not flown low-wing aircraft much at all. Is it easier to scrape a wing doing that in a low-wing aircraft?
To scrape a wing, given the fact that, these airplanes have a bit of dihedral in them, you'd certainly have to be sensitive to not wanting to. You don't have to go that low. All we have to do is to lean the wing into the wind in such a way that just 51% of it has got a downward slope. So the wind striking the wing is going to tend to push it downward as opposed to pushing it upward. And it doesn't take a lot of bank to make that happen, just a little bit. Just a little bit to get that wingtip a little bit below the horizon, I think, is maybe the way to look at it, where the wind is coming from. It's all it takes. And we don't have to get into a deep, steep bank over the runway. Just a little bit to keep that upwind wing down low so that when gusts press on the wing or hit the wing tends to go down rather than up.
That's great, Bob. I'm going to write this down. In fact, I think I'll call it the 51% rule. No, wait a minute. That would be confusing, wouldn't it? Well, Bob, we really appreciate this. I know people are going to hear this who maybe went out and ground looped their airplane over the weekend, and they're probably slapping their forehead about now. But it's good information for those who have it.
Well, you know, at the risk of redundancy and overstatement, you know, this again, there are so many opportunities to practice crosswind landings that we never take advantage of. Honestly, every tower controlled airport, you know, brings us in on the wind on the runway most favoring the winds. We have to go out and specifically request the crosswind runway to get training. And every time we fly, if the winds are up a little bit, try to find an airport where the winds are coming directly across the runway and practice it. You know, if we're always landing on the most favorable wind runway, we're never going to develop the skills that we need to handle this.
Well, Bob, as always, we appreciate your input, and we'll refer our listeners to Over the Airwaves and talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks a lot, Paul. See you soon.
My guest has been Bob Miller. You can find Bob's writings at overtheairwaves.com. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend and have a clear and unlimited day.